not poisonous in any way. Nutritionists assure us that if most people weren't so squeamish about eating food that moves, they wouldn't need to purge the infested boxes from their shelves. The bad news about these invisible invaders is that if they aren't found early enough, they can ruin an entire pantry of food. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University. Today's program was prepared by Barbara Boltz with help from Susan Berg. I'm Yael Cassander.
Thanks for listening to WILL, Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Robert and Alice Campbell. We turn our attention next to sports. The NFL Thursday night game is being played in Cleveland with the Browns playing host to Pittsburgh. Snow squalls are expected all day with a temperature this evening of around 14 degrees. The Browns entered the game 1-11 while the Steelers are 6-6. The defending NBA champion Lakers just keep on rolling. They had held visiting Utah to just 6 points in the fourth quarter and 25 in the second half last night in their 101-77 victory. Kobe Bryant led the way with 27 points. A Southeast versus Northwest Division contest tops the NBA card this evening. In Salt Lake City, the Jazz are playing host to Orlando. The Magic top the Southeast Division with a record of 17-4, while the Jazz are 12-9 in third place in the Northwest. Kansas, the top-ranked team in the Associated Press top 25 men's basketball poll, remains unbeaten after 8 games. The Jayhawks, playing on their home floor last night, destroyed visiting Radford, the score 99-64. And the DePaul Blue Demons play Mississippi State tonight as part of the SEC Big East Invitational. The game is being played in Tampa, Florida. That's sports.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Joyce Foundation and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
It's 2:42. Adam Lentz is taking a week from his studies at the University of Illinois to go back to his hometown in Europe. But it will be a working break. His home is Copenhagen, where representatives from the world's countries have gathered to hammer out an agreement on climate change. Lentz is a Fulbright graduate student studying natural resources and environmental science. When he was an undergraduate at the University of Copenhagen, he was the president of the Union of Danish Natural Resource Students. He is going to the Copenhagen summit to monitor its progress, and he sat down with Tom Rogers to talk about his expectations, not wanting to predict a solid agreement.
I think if I had the good answer, I would be playing with the bookmakers to make money on it. But I think there will be some kind of agreement. But it has to be seen in the perspective of the economic interest that everybody has. So all the countries have different interests. And what we have been seeing for the last 6 months, sort of the build-up for it, is that they all play this game where it's about releasing information at the best time in order to promote the country's personal interest, and also even the interest groups, the lobbyists, whether it's the environmental groups or the industry lobbies. So I think it's hard to say what the outcome will be, but there will be some kind of political agreement, hopefully with some numbers on what the individual countries will be willing to reduce, but probably it will be on a very long time horizons, because what they did in Kyoto was that they were talking about a 15 years time horizon, and that's just easier for politicians.
And even with that 15 year horizon, there are a lot of countries that from the start decided not to be a part of the Kyoto Agreement, and others that have dropped out or have not followed through with their pledges.
Yeah, that is true, and that's because politicians, they're new people in office once in a while, and they have different policies and different takes on this. So I think we'll see a long time horizon. I think it's exciting to follow the development between China and the States, because every time the States come out with something, China is there 5 minutes after. So I think essentially it comes down to that question, whether the game between U.S. and China is going to be successful.
A lot of attention has also been placed on India, another rising power, and they have yet a different take than China as far as complying with this.
Yeah, they are probably even more conservative than China is, but in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But I see India is sort of the back tire of China. They come right after and follow in the track of China. And they actually increased their dialogue on climate change just recently. So a couple of weeks ago when Obama, he first released the first numbers that they that the U.S. would be willing to reduce by, China came out 2 hours after. India was there 1 hour after. And that is a coordinated effort, I'm pretty sure.
If you see an agreement coming out with long deadlines, how useful will something like that be in terms of what many scientists say is an immediate threat?
My area of study is mainly the political side of these things. Mm-hmm. And I think you can take two perspectives on that. Are you a pragmatic that say this is better than nothing? That was what most people they thought after the Kyoto. At least we have an agreement. We'll see what will happen, actually, if it will be implemented. And that's sort of the pragmatic view. What I think many environmental groups will feel is that, yet again, it has been postponed out in the horizon, and we don't know what that will be. And I think a lot of people will be disappointed about that. But it all comes back down to what perspective you take. And I hope that there will – my personal hope is that there will be some kind of agreement, because that's better than nothing. And that's essentially what we need now. We need something that can follow up on the Kyoto when that expires in 2012, because it takes time to implement these policies.
Adam Lentz is leaving tomorrow for his native Denmark to sit in on the Copenhagen Climate Conference. He says the recent revelation of leaked emails containing discussions among climate scientists put science in a bad light, but most countries have already committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. One of the goals in Copenhagen is to slow the destruction of forests in developing countries. Those forests process and store massive amounts of carbon dioxide, Anne Dornfeld reports.
Preserving forests will be a huge debate in Copenhagen. Poor countries want wealthier countries to compensate them for not cutting the forest for lumber and to convert it to farmland. To find out why that might be important, you have to visit a place like this peat forest on the Indonesian island of Sumatra. Forests like this one are home to orangutans, Sumatran tigers, and Asian elephants. But these forests may be more important for what lies beneath their marshy floors. The peat is composed of thousands of years' worth of organic material. Indonesia's peat forests are storage units for much of the world's carbon, and they're being destroyed at an alarming rate. Not far down the road, Bustar Maitar looks out on a charred landscape. He works for Greenpeace Indonesia. You'd never know a forest stood here just a few months ago.
It's the normal ecosystem here. It's the normal forest here.
Only a few burnt tree trunks are standing. Maitar says this fire has been burning for a month.
Fire is coming not from in the top of the ground, but the haze is coming from inside. It means it's the underground fire, especially in peatland. And underground fire is very difficult to handling.
Indonesia's peat forests are rapidly being logged, drained, and burned in order to clear the land for tree farms and palm oil plantations. The peat can be dozens of feet deep. When it's burned, the carbon it's been storing is released as carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. All of that burning peat has made Indonesia the world's third largest emitter of CO2. Until recently, industrialized nations topped the list of greenhouse gas emitters. Now the United States shares that short list with developing nations like China, India, and Brazil. As these countries industrialize, demand for timber and open space has stripped many of their forests bare. But leaders of developing countries insist their nations should be allowed to do what it takes to build their economies, even if that leads to climate change. Paul Wynn works on forest and climate issues for Greenpeace. He says the only alternative is for wealthy countries to pay developing countries to slow their emissions.
If the industrialized world is serious about climate change, it's essential. It just has to be.
Wynn says wealthy countries have pledged $45 billion so far to help poor countries reduce emissions. But he says that's just a start.
if you compare that to what the industrialized world spent on protecting its banks and its financial institutions during the financial crisis, it's a pittance. And it's far more essential that they do it now, because these forests are threatened and the emissions that go up into the atmosphere are going to come back and bite the industrialized world if they don't fund its protection.
Some of the funding plans on the table at Copenhagen would still involve drastic changes to the world's forest ecosystems. The UN's current plan would give pulp and paper corporations in Indonesia carbon credits to convert peat forests into acacia plantations. Wynne says that's the opposite of what needs to happen. Greenpeace and other environmental groups want industrialized countries to fund a moratorium on logging in countries like Indonesia. One complicating factor is the rampant corruption in many developing countries.
It is a concern. I would imagine that's why many of the industrialized countries haven't yet committed to funding.
Wynne says a thorough verification process would ensure that if countries allowed logging, they'd have to repay donor nations. Wynne is in Copenhagen to promote forest protection in the developing world. He says he doesn't expect anything major to come out of the conference, but hopefully it'll lay some groundwork. For the Environment Report, I'm Ann Dornfeld.
Charles Babbage never got to see his life's work completed. Babbage is considered by many to be the father of modern computing. Now, a 5-ton computing engine built more than 120 years after his death is on display at the Computer History Museum in California's Silicon Valley. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Babbage's massive engine stands taller than most men and fills half a gallery. Its 8,000 parts of cast iron, steel, and bronze fit together in a tight weave. But you can't just plug in this engine. It's powered by hand crank.
It absolutely is a good workout.
Tim Robinson is a docent here at the museum who recently retired from a career in computer systems. As he turns the crank, the parts move in synchronicity. Wheels with numbers align to make perfect calculations.
What is special about it is it's the first automatic calculating machine. That is a machine in which you set it up to solve a particular problem. Its operation is entirely automatic. As long as you keep turning that crank, it will produce new results.
And most importantly, accurate results that are pressed into a mold to make printing plates for books. Babbage was a citizen of Victorian England, a nation that relied on its navy to maintain its vast empire. The books were filled with mathematical calculations necessary for navigation.
And if the tables had an error, you get the wrong answer. A ship could either get lost or run aground, so lives and property were thought to be at stake.
The story goes that one day Babbage, a mathematician, came across so many errors in a book, he exclaimed, "I wish to God these calculations had been executed by steam." He was inspired to design his difference engine. He got money from the British government, but after 10 years of work, the government wouldn't give him more.
He was so far ahead of his time in his thinking that many people opposed what he was trying to do on the grounds that they just didn't understand.
Babbage's unfinished engine was turned to scrap metal, leaving nothing but his drafts and drawings. He remained largely an inspirational figure. No one was sure his engine would have worked. And then, in the 1980s, Dr. Doran Swade, then a curator at the Science Museum in London, started reading about him.
And when I got to the point where it said Babbage failed because of limitations of Victorian engineering, I sort of quickly flipped ahead to say, well, okay, did the engine work when they did build it, when these limitations no longer applied? And was staggered to discover that nobody had actually ever tried.
But Swade tried. It took Swade and his collaborators 17 years. They used only materials that would have been available to Babbage in his time. They built two engines. One is on display at the Science Museum in London. The other is here at the Computer History Museum. It was flown to California, 5 tons, remember, on a 747. The museum's Tim Robinson.
I think now he is recognized as a true genius. If the rest of the world had appreciated the significance of what he was trying to achieve, things might have turned out differently.
Differently, because if Babbage had actually completed his engine, he might have had the support to build what historians consider to be his greatest design, the analytic engine, which shares many features with early computers.
It would have been programmed on punch cards, the kind of cards that were being used at that time to automate weaving looms.
Babbage also inspired the woman who many now call the mother of computer programming, Ada Lovelace. Lovelace, the daughter of the poet Lord Byron, met Babbage during one of his London soirees. She helped Babbage put his ideas in writing, and she often understood the implications of his work better than he did.
Now, I'm dreaming of an engine Like Babbage's.
Tilda Swinton played Ada Lovelace in this 1997 film, Conceiving Ada.
That will one day allow us to predict an infinite series of numerical outcomes. And that could immediately be put to all sorts of practical uses.
The Computer History Museum's Tim Robinson.
Ada recognized that you could actually use numbers to represent things other than just quantity. They could represent letters of the alphabet, they could represent musical notes, they could represent positions on a chessboard. And so she speculated what might be achieved. You know, thinking about computer chess in the 1840s is kind of way out there, right?
Even today, when Dr. Doran Swade turns the crank of Babbage's bronze and steel engine in London, people are amazed when they see it work.
I still never fail to receive huge pleasure from watching people's reaction when they first see this extraordinary spectacle. Their jaws literally drop.
Swade believes if Babbage had completed the difference engine in his time, it might have inspired a Victorian information age. Instead, he died an embittered old man with a tarnished reputation. The difference engine at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, will be on display through the end of next year. Then it goes to Seattle, where it will become part of a private collection. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Earth and Sky.
Hawaii is one of the few places where new land is made every single day. The next island is growing up from the seafloor.
You're listening to John Wiltshire, director of the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory. He organizes undersea explorations to study the depths of the Pacific Ocean, including the growth of the newest Hawaiian island.
It grows up through a series of volcanic eruptions, and then it will collapse. Parts of it will collapse, much as you would put gravel on a gravel pile and dump more and more gravel on the top, and then some slides down the side.
Every year, Wiltshire's research vessels survey the new craters and landslides. He sends down remotely operated vehicles, which are underwater robots, to explore the emerging island.
It's about 20 miles offshore from the island of Hawaii, and we expect it to break water anywhere between a few hundred and 50,000 years. The best estimate is perhaps 10,000 years from now. It will break water, so it's a little early to buy real estate yet.
Wiltshire's undersea lab has also explored World War II shipwrecks, documented changes in the deep sea, and studied ancient precious corals. Our thanks today to NOAA Pacific Services Center. I'm Lindsay Patterson. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, presenting the CU Symphony Holiday Concert on Thursday, December 10th at 7:30 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts.